While Julie Posetti gets her presentation ready, I'd just like to welcome her on behalf of Oscomet and the Digital Journalism Research Group, but she will also have this talk featured as a focus seminar in our speaking series. Julie Posetti has been researching and teaching in Australia for a number of years. She's an award-winning journalist in Australia. I can honestly say I wasn't familiar with Julie Posetti's work until like 1.5 years ago. And soon after she started working at the Reuters Institute at Oxford University, suddenly she was appearing everywhere, publishing reports on shiny new things, and we realized she's been working for a long time with One IFRA and their reports. I was familiar a bit with that work. But now she's publishing all the time, everywhere, and she works with UNESCO getting new projects. She leads research. She has affiliation with Sheffield, and she recently also got a job for the International Institute for Journalism in Washington. So there's a lot going on in Julie Posetti's life. And the first time we met was at the Future of Journalism conference in Cardiff, and I realized there were two competing conferences at the same time, and she needed to make a decision which to prioritize. So we're extremely grateful that she can allocate time to be here as a fellow and presenter at this conference. Thank you, Julie. You deserve all the time you have now.
Thank you, Oscar. Yes, I did choose this conference, and I'd also like to thank the British Home Office for providing the visa, which allowed me to leave the country just in the nick of time. So I won't mention Brexit beyond that brief interlude. Look, thanks very much for having me. It's an honour to be here. I have been working, as Oscar says, for some time now, a decade and a half, but for the last 5 to 7 years, really focused on the intersectional issues of digital rights, digital safety, journalism, privacy, and gender. And I'm going to try and bring a lot of that work together. So, in fact, just 2 years ago, almost exactly 2 years ago, I was in Oslo delivering a keynote speech for the Equality and Anti-Discrimination Ombuds Conference, and they presciently asked me to talk about online hate, which we've heard quite a bit about this past few days. And the title of my talk was Dealing with Online Abuse and Hate, Global Editorial Experiences and Strategies for Combating an Increasingly Pernicious Problem. Now, as I said, I've been studying and reporting on these issues because I very much work at the intersection of journalism and academia and training for several years, since 2013, in fact. And I just finished, when I did this talk, a 2-year stint as head of digital editorial capability at Fairfax Media in Australia, which was then the biggest news publisher in the country and the oldest. And one of my core missions was to develop policy and training in online safety and security to hundreds of journalists who were, unsurprisingly, now we've heard much evidence of this globally, reluctant to acknowledge the problem of gendered online harassment while increasingly suffering from its impacts, and at the same time as their bosses were walking around essentially sleepwalking or blindfolded. So this was quite an important experience for me to be within a news organisation trying to tackle the problems I'd been researching on and then to learn from the experience of doing that policy work and training work and editorial advocacy work as a researcher coming out of industry again. But as we've heard over the past 3 days, online harassment is now widely recognised as a global scourge. And efforts to map it and understand the threat and forge collaborative responses are certainly well underway. But the problem is now more widespread, more entrenched, and more complex than it was 2 years ago. And it's an epic battle for freedom of expression online, which I think Silvio potently highlighted for us, and others have as well. And there's still a lot of work to be done. So what I want to talk about this afternoon is one of the most important themes, I think, to emerge from an analytical synthesis I've done of my research on these converging themes. Research that's been published by UNESCO, the Reuters Institute, the World Editors Forum, and NGOs, and it's the new front line of journalism safety, where journalists really sit at the intersection of converging risks. So the most urgent safety and security threats confronting digital age journalism are converging, as I said, and female journalists are at the epicentre of risk. Two examples here. One is Gauri Lankesh, the Indian journalist, murdered in 2017, and the other is Daphne Caruana Galizia, who was murdered in Malta. These are two women journalists murdered for their work with impunity. Both of them were doing investigative reporting that attempted to reveal corruption and or the implications of nationalism and populism in their countries. Both of them were brutally harassed online before they were murdered, and in the aftermath of their murders, the people who were reporting on and supporting investigations into their deaths were similarly targeted for gendered online harassment. So similar to what Guy had said on Thursday night in his opening keynote, you know, maybe we need to start thinking very holistically now rather than separating these issues out so much that the digital and psychological and physical safety threats, particularly confronted by women journalists, are inseparable, and they can be terrifying when they do intersect and where they do intersect, and deadly. So the convergent threats that I'm talking about here can be identified as a trifecta, if you like. The first is online violence and abuse, which I've just referenced. The second is orchestrated disinformation campaigns in which female journalists are prime targets. And many of the journalists I've interviewed in the research that I'll discuss today did describe their experience of attack and assault online and offline and where they intersected in terms of war. They used phrases like battle, trench warfare, they talked about assaults, they talked about weaponization. War was mentioned constantly, and I think that says something potent about the ways in which issues confronting women journalists offline, we know that rape is a weapon of war and rape and sexual assault and harassment are used in the context of physical conflict against women journalists, and certainly there are correlations in the online environment with that. The third element is privacy erosion. And by privacy erosion, I'm talking about the safety threats that risking exposure of confidential sources and whistleblowers entail, but also the sorts of safety threats that include the exposure of identifying information. And that identifying information can include addresses, health records, marital status, gender, sexual orientation, a whole range of additional factors that can increase the threats against women. So it also can include criminalisation of investigative journalism via national security overreach, which leads to mass surveillance and device seizure and communications interceptions, all of which increase the insecurity of communications online and exacerbate exposure. So female journalists are more vulnerable online due to their gender. It makes them a bigger target for harassment and abuse. And the attacks are more frequent. They're also often more prolific, as Guy has already suggested. They're also more violent and sexualised, and they're accompanied very often by threats to attack the children, the female children, and the mothers of journalists. So there's a kind of radiating effect here. There's much research published, and Guy's previewed some of it, by civil society organisations. Increasingly, we're starting to see academic research on this theme. There's some references there, but it's useful to think about the ways in which academics examined the experiences of women bloggers back around 2007 to 2009. We were talking about the sort of gendered attacks on female bloggers, and there are parallels there worth considering, I think. So how does this trifecta manifest? So it's networked. We see examples of organic and organised attacks, state-sponsored attacks, computational propaganda. You hear references to sock puppet networks, troll armies, pylons, misogynistic pylons, troll armies, I think I said, sock puppet networks again, these sorts of terms that that you hear in reference to online safety threats confronting women journalists at the intersection of disinformation. But they often also and increasingly involve these digital privacy threats. So I've highlighted a few, but doxing and spoofing and phishing, malware, these are important events to note and to look out for. And importantly, as I've highlighted, this radiates. So sources and audiences are also targeted and caught up in the mix, and the chilling effects extend to them as well. So we also see really explicit verbal abuse and explicit imagery that's increasingly manifesting as manipulated representation of female journalists, either in photographs that have been manipulated or in deepfake videos, for example, and I'll show you some examples, not of the actual videos, but of case studies involving that. And it's very intimate, both in its detail and delivery. And there's a quote there from Alexander Pascalidou, who's one of the very early journalists to speak out around 2014, 2015, about her experiences. And she described an intersectional experience of being Greek, living in Sweden, and being a woman. And I think it's important to hear her words spoken, because they were powerful words the first time I heard them, so I'm going to read them to you. There are days when I wake up to verbal violence and I fall asleep with the sexist and racist rage echoing in my ears. It's like a low, intense, constant warfare, she said. And I just want to give you a moment to read this quote. This is one of the first documented cases of really prolific and horrific online violence against a woman journalist. This is Caroline Criado Perez, and her great sin was to campaign and write in defence of the need for women on UK currency, namely Jane Austen, who happens to be my favourite author, who wanted to put Jane Austen on the £5 note. So she was threatened in the most graphic ways imaginable. And the reason I'm including this quote and others like it is because we have talked about the new normal. We have talked about the potential desensitisation to this problem. We cannot let this become normal. This is graphic, it's horrific, it's damaging, it's chilling to our journalism, but also to our psychological well-being, and frankly, the physical fear that comes with reading messages like that for a woman who is used to feeling unsafe when she walks down a street, because that's our daily lived experience. As a journalist who is daring to investigate, daring to challenge the patriarchy, to experience this kind of threat in the context of campaigning or any journalism is something that I think we need to take very seriously as scholars, as journalists, as activists. So forgive me if if you find this quote or others offensive, but I think it's time to go back and have a look at those. And here are some examples, some of which I will delve into now in more detail, of women who have been caught up at this intersection where digital safety and security threats meet disinformation and gendered online harassment. To your left is Ferial Haffagy, a very prominent, exceptional South African editor and investigative reporter. She is somebody who I'm going to focus on in a bit more detail, but suffice to say, the tweet you can see there at the top left of your screen is an example of a manipulated image designed to discredit her and humiliate her. Next to her is Jessica Aro, who is a Finnish reporter with YLE. I'll come to her case study in more detail, but suffice it to say, one of the lightning rod story types for attracting this level of threat is reporting on troll armies in and of itself. Jessica Valenti, who I won't go into detail on, is a US-based columnist, and I think her tweet there is powerfully demonstrative of the kind of radiation effect that I'm talking about. If we go clockwise, that's Maria Ressa, a very famous face now, not at the time this picture was taken and not at the time when she was dealing with the most horrific onslaught of abuse. Again, I'm going to be talking about her in a bit more detail. Rana Ayub is standing next to her, a celebrated Indian investigative journalist who's been the subject of such prolific abuse that the UN, through its rapporteurs, intervened in her case. I'll come and speak a bit about her as well. Next to her is Zoe Quinn, who is the woman involved in the Gamergate case that Silvio mentioned the other day, and it's worth having a look at. And the final one is Alexandra Pascalidou, whose quote we saw earlier. So what I want to do now is to go through four of these case studies, Maria Ressa, Rana Ayub, and Ferial Haffaji, along with Jessica Aro. Now, these case studies are actually featured, not in detail, but featured as exemplars of what I'm describing in this handbook that I edited with Sherilyn Ireton for UNESCO, which is now, I think, going 11 or 13 languages that's been translated into. So it's finding traction all over the place, and I'd point you to Module 7 in particular in reference to what we're discussing here today, about how to deal with these intersecting issues. I've got one copy of that, and I think it's already promised, so someone will have to battle me afterwards if they want it. So Maria Ressa, who was a CNN foreign correspondent, who wrote a high-profile book about her time reporting on Southeast Asian terrorist networks called From Bin Laden to Facebook. She said despite her experiences and her encounters with death, near-death, rather, experiences, what she has experienced since 2016, which was triggered by the troll armies that she later, through investigative journalism, determined were directed by people working in the communications office of President Duterte, that pylon and the ongoing attacks, which now include 11 legal cases that she's confronting and decades in jail if she's found guilty, that is a far worse lived experience than being in a war zone as a reporter. So she talks about this as like a perfect storm situation, where there are attacks on media freedom, politicised attacks on media freedom through the targeting of news organisations doing critical reporting. They're using disinformation tactics to discredit the journalists, and one of the ways they discredit the journalists and chill their journalism is by targeting the women. Rappler is an almost entirely feminised workplace. It's run by four women who are very experienced journalists, and it has a predominantly female staff. And they were subjected to some really horrific threats, rape, murder, hashtags like arrest Maria Ressa and bring her to the Senate. One of those attacks came in the form of this post via Facebook. I want Maria Ressa to be raped repeatedly to death. I'd be happy if that would happen when martial law is declared. It would bring joy to my heart. She still talks about that. That was in 2016 as something that really frightened her. I mean, she now, as people have said, has to live with security guards. She resisted that for as long as she could. And she talks about the way her gender, her sexuality, her physical appearance, they're constantly used in combination with lies about her journalism to discredit her, when one of her primary responses to these attacks has ultimately been to name it, to call it out, and to produce investigative reporting based on mapping and the networks of troll armies connected to disinformation actors into other states. Most recently, they've identified links between Russian troll farms and the attacks on journalists in the Philippines. So she talks about the ways in which this happened. Messages were planted within groups, and then the mob would attack. This was like a form of both combination of patriotic trolling, where mobs of misogynists would target misogynistic tendencies, but also the sort of patriarchal approaches that that favour nationalism, for example. So they would mix all this stuff up. It would be she was an American who wasn't a real Filipino, who was ugly, you know, so on and so forth, and who was an ineffective journalist, an illegitimate journalist. Her primary response, and I think this is important to note, is one of the key responses for journalists in the Global South trying to maintain independent critical reporting in environments where the threats are existential on a range of fronts, is this trend towards refusing to remain silent and doing remarkable work to try and build trust with core audiences who can assist with the defence of the journalism and the journalists. She says it's just impossible to stay silent. So Ferial Hafaji, who now is with the Daily Maverick in South Africa, she began being abused when she was with the Huffington Post, and she wrote about the kinds of attacks she was enduring while she was reporting in and around what came to be known as well, in reference to Gupta leaks, so issues around state capture in South Africa. So again, really important stories, powerful political stories connected to corruption. Now, though, after many years of finding the internet a place, and social media in particular, a place where she could identify stories and communities who would collaborate with her in the kind of engaged open journalism that we believe for the last 10 years would sustain us possibly as a profession, she's now talking about leaving social media because of what she says here and what she's written about. It's been so weaponized, she feels unsafe there. And she recently said that she feels like she can't even go to press conferences anymore and ask confident questions because of what might happen to her afterwards in terms of online attacks. There's direct chilling that she's experiencing. And what she highlights there, and she's talked about this too in interviews with me, that that what goes on off online can very easily exist what goes on online can very easily transfer into an offline environment, to physical threats. And in volatile societies, that's extremely risky, of course. This is Rana Ayoob, who I mentioned before. She got the most extraordinary rate of hate messages targeting her through Twitter, but also through WhatsApp groups. One of the key features of this, which were identified as being new at the time in the middle of 2018 or the beginning of 2018, was the use of deepfake videos to portray her as a porn star, which extended the risk to her own Muslim community, her conservative family and friends, where this was believed to be true in some parts. And she said she had to spend an awful lot of energy and time trying to convince her family and community that, you know, this was not in fact her. And when they were using imposter Twitter accounts to purport that she was a sympathiser of child rapists, and that the extension of the threats to her and the escalation of threats to her became so severe that ultimately she spoke about this publicly in a very powerful way, and UN special rapporteurs intervened with a statement calling on the Indian government to ensure her protection, citing the earlier murder of Gauri Lankesh in India, who was her friend, as an example of what potentially could happen to her. She continues to deal with these sorts of threats, and she continues to speak out against it. And like Maria Ressa, she's been given numerous awards for journalism and bravery. Her investigations, like the others I'm talking about here, intersect with reporting on populist movements, far-right politics, Hindu nationalism in the case of Rana Ayoob. And this is Jessica Aro. So she, in 2014, began investigating troll networks. And those troll networks, she's a Finnish journalist with Wiley, and she was investigating troll networks that she described as Russian troll armies. So, of course, the politics between Finland and Russia are extremely problematic, but so was the notion of a woman investigative reporter from Finland daring to expose troll networks. And the nature of the attacks on her were also extremely sexualised. So they did things like produce very professional-looking music videos about her to ridicule her. That's one thing. They also then spread falsehoods about her being a prostitute who was servicing NATO operatives. So trying to, you know, bring the sort of politicisation to the fore. And that resulted in an escalation. She says women are targeted in cyber wars the same way as they are in kinetic wars, which is the point I was reflecting earlier. And I think that is something to consider. She's actually celebrated currently because she has managed to win a case, at least in the lower courts, against the two men identified as her online attackers, or at least those orchestrating the online attacks. One of them was sentenced to 2 years in jail, but it's a case that's under appeal at the moment. This is cited as an example of the ways that law enforcement and judiciary could actually work positively to ensure the reinforcement of offline rights for women journalists online. But we'll have to wait to see what happens. And if somebody has a breaking news story for me, a colleague from Finland who I missed earlier, do we know whether there's an outcome?
No.
No. Okay.
But, there have been hearings, so it's still the court is deciding on that.
Yeah. All right. So let's think about the intentions of these malicious actors. Do I have any more time, Kristen? Can I keep going? Excellent. So what are the objectives, do we think? I mean, this is based on the journalist's assessment of why they think they are being targeted and what they think the motivations are. They include the idea of shutting women up, discrediting and sullying their reputations, which goes not just to their own professional identities but also their employers, the credibility of their journalism, feeding the distrust that we see so much research on within audiences with regard to professional journalism. Risk and fear increasing, that's one of the objectives, they say. The idea of chilling the critical accountability journalism that they're doing. One of the other sources is, in terms of identifying intent, is a desire to expose or endanger sources, and in so doing, there are flow-on effects of a particular gendered nature for those women who are targeted and sources themselves. Chilling public participation in conversations online of journalists and their sources, and manipulating public opinion for political gain, as well as ultimately undermining media freedom and the public's right to know. So these are some significant identified potential motivations of the malicious actors. What I think we need is research in parallel with what's going on in terms of the impacts and responses to online harassment within journalism. We need research that helps us identify the motivations of the nefarious actors and the ways in which they find traction for their hate and their disinformation, for example. So the three of the women I highlighted are relevant to the two most recent reports I've produced for the Reuters Institute, which sought to reinvent understandings of journalism innovation to consider what innovation looks like in the global south in organisations struggling with genuine existential crises, and by genuine I mean actually life-threatening existential crises. And the theme that kept coming up, two things. That the biggest challenge was not necessarily the business model, it was survival, physical survival, and that critical to the success of the business model and the survival of their news organisation was the capacity to creatively and innovatively confront media freedom threats, namely the chilling of online communities, public conversation that serves journalism, the chilling of the sources connected to threats and attacks that are often magnified online, and also the digital security threats that increasingly are confronting them. So at Rappler, for example, they recently had to close, about 3 months ago, their community and citizen blogging platform because it came under cyber attack. There were attempts to plant malware, there were attempts to post false narrative stories on the website, so they've actually had to pull back in a range of ways. And that second report there, What is Scale Breaks Community, unpacks some of the work that's being done by these three news organisations to try to deal with these unintended consequences, if you like, of our foray into open journalism at scale, which has become extremely problematic. And each of these organisations detail how they've had to deal with graphic prolific and extremely damaging online harassment, particularly targeting the women who work for these organisations. And the strategies that they've developed to try to respond to these threats include trying to build narrower and deeper and more closed online communities to enable their journalists to pull back into safer environments where possible. They acknowledge that they can't necessarily pull back altogether from open platforms, but they're talking about doing things in ways that help build confidence in their audiences through trust in the work that they're producing, but also get them to serve as their defenders in public spaces and as their financial defenders. So each of these organisations has now built a membership model. So what they're doing is leveraging the loyal audiences who are with them in the media freedom fight, who are defending them online against their attackers, to support their businesses, which I think is a very interesting development. The other sorts of things that are happening are really creative investigative reporting on disinformation networks. Many of the strategies we've heard flagged in different sessions here, like identifying the lightning rod stories and so on, have been identified by them as well as strategies worth implementing. So, yeah, speaking out as well to build protection through awareness, modelling their management models and their resources through collaborations with other news organisations. That's particularly prevalent in South Africa and in the Philippines, where journalists who've been targeted at those news organisations have led meetings, sometimes meetings in their home. So I was at dinner with Maria in February at her home, where she had 9 other editors and senior journalists around her dinner table talking about how we would tackle collectively. She had academics in the room too, actually, how we would tackle this crisis together. And she talks a lot about this problem, this intersectional problem, being so relevant to the West because it's a problem that's being ported to the West. So she says, you know, we are the Philippines, we are democracy's dystopian future, is one of her comments. And I think should cause pause for thought. I don't have time to do my incredibly long 17-point plan for combat, so I'm just going to leave this up there. But what I will do is commit to a very long Twitter thread in which I shall share both all of these resources, which includes protecting journalism sources in the digital age, which goes to the necessity to include responses to the digital safety and security threats that we face. And I will say that there's recommendations in each of these reports, including the Perugia Principles for Journalists, which is all around digital safety and security. And Guy mentioned this book earlier. There's a chapter in there that I wrote with Hannah Storm on the need to develop holistic strategies to deal with journalism safety as regards women journalists. So there's plenty of resources, which I will share in a Twitter thread, along with some of these recommendations. But the most important point, and the point that I'd like to end on, is this question of how we can work across boundaries together. And by boundaries, I mean both between academia and journalism and civil society, but also within news organisations and between news organisations. You know, we need to figure out, as a society, how we tackle this problem. Journalism has an important function in fulfilling it, and journalism is best supported by robust research into these issues. So I think that's where I'll end. And if we have 1 or 2 minutes for questions, then Guy and I can do that. Thank you.